Good evening. My name is Tony Heilman. I'm the senior leader of the New York Society for Ethical Culture. And I want to welcome you to our home and what promises to be a fascinating experience this evening. I also want to thank all of you who stopped by our information booth on the way in, especially those of you who took advantage of the opportunity to make a donation. This event and others like it are open to the public and free only through your generosity. And I also want to welcome our distinguished guests this evening, who will be introduced to you shortly, and thank our co-sponsors, Human Rights First and Amnesty International. You of course know them, but I suspect that ethical culture may not be as well known to some of you. The New York Society for Ethical Culture is the founding society of a movement that has been proudly progressive for over 130 years. We are humanists, and as such, we place faith in the demonstrated ability of people to do wonderful things. We stand for the worth and dignity of all people and consequently hold life precious. Our members have a long and storied tradition of activism and advocacy on civil liberties and human rights issues. And like many of you, we work to secure equal justice and opportunity for all in a caring, compassionate world. At the same time, we realize that not everyone does. We recognize that atrocities continue largely unnoticed, that killing, raping, maiming, and go on an unimaginable scale and fail to grab the world's attention. Nothing is more offensive to the worth and dignity of humanity as the terrorizing and extermination of masses of people unable to protect themselves and even to garner the empathy of world opinion. We have a moral responsibility to change that and to ensure that never again means never again to anyone. One of the commitments of we ethical culturists make to ourselves and to the world we live in is to the commitment to continuously educate ourselves and others in ways that enable us all to act more considerately and humanely. This evening's program is a continuation of that effort. I invite you to get to know us better by checking us out on the web at NYSEC, that's NYSEC.org, or you can stop by our table in the lobby where you can pick up literature and sign up to receive direct notification of other events like this. And where, if you haven't already, and if you're so inclined, you can make a small or a large contribution to the society. This is a grand landmark building that houses many, many activities like this one. It's also a big and expensive place to keep available. So if you like what you experience this evening, please help us continue to serve New York and the world. And now I'm going to turn this podium over to the chair of the organizing committee for this evening's affair, Denise Bell. Thank you all. Have a wonderful evening.
Hi, and welcome to this evening's panel, The Best Hope for Peace in Darfur. I'm here as a representative of Amnesty International, which is an international human rights organization. I especially thank you for coming tonight because there are so many other events going on in New York City right now, but you chose this one, a panel about systematic state-sponsored murders, rapes, abductions, enslavement, torture, and displacement. But the panel's also about hope, and the best hope for peace in Darfur is you. Without the attention of individuals like you at panels like this, writing letters, making phone calls, as we suggest in the program, the killings and the rapes will continue. Sudan knows that it can act with impunity. The government has been playing with words for the past 3 years to buy time until it is finished with what it set out to do, which is displace, disable, and harm the people living in Darfur. I don't work for Amnesty International. I'm a volunteer. I have a daytime job, and a very accommodating business partner. And I'm doing this because I'm outraged, even angry at what's going on. And also because our word must mean something. Whether we call this genocide or ethnic cleansing, we've labeled the atrocities as something horrific, and we are compelled to act. We are not alone, and that's what's important to remember. I represent a national movement of activists who are building momentum for action for our government to assert leadership on ending the atrocities in Darfur. What's exciting is that we represent a range of communities coming together, students, faith-based organizations, ordinary citizens like you and me. John Prendergast, who is an expert on African matters, has said that not since the anti-apartheid movement has he witnessed such a national, growing activism on an African country. You, we, are the best hope, and with our citizen pressure, only with our citizens' pressure, will our elected leaders act. I hope that you will act and follow what is in the programs. And also to hand in the postcards when you leave. Ushers will be collecting them at the doors. Before I go, I'd like to thank the Special Initiatives Fund of Amnesty International for awarding my organizing committee a small grant to produce this panel. Also, I'd like to thank our co-sponsors, New York Society for Ethical Culture and Human Rights First, who have been tremendously supportive in this endeavor, and especially Leslie Doyle of the New York Society for Ethical Culture. I'd also like to thank Florinda Russo and the staff of Amnesty International for their incredible support of this volunteer effort. And to my committee, there are only five of us, and all of the volunteers, thank you. And lastly, I thank our distinguished panelists. Several months ago, they carved out time to be here, and I'm very grateful that they're here speaking tonight. And next, Maureen Burns, the Executive Director of Human Rights First, will be speaking about her organization.
It is truly heartening to see so many of you here in this beautiful building this evening, to come and listen to this distinguished panel and to explore together as a group what it is that we can do right now, this evening, to address the tragedy that is occurring in Darfur right now, this evening, while we meet in this beautiful building and listen to this distinguished panel. Part of our job is to find ways to make the tragedy real, help others understand the urgency, and to make our voices heard. We all need to find our own ways to express ourselves, and at Human Rights First, we have launched a Hope for Darfur campaign, which includes an opportunity for each of us to go to the Human Rights First website and stand in and be counted for one of the many victims in Darfur. It is one way that we are trying to convey a sense of the magnitude of the crisis in terms of the numbers, and to connect people here in the United States and around the world to other members of our human family who are in crisis today, tonight, in Darfur. Human Rights First is a nonprofit advocacy organization based here in New York City with an office in Washington, D.C. Some of you may remember us under our old name, the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. Since 1978, we have worked in the United States and around the world to advance justice, human dignity, and respect for the rule of law. We have programs that protect the rights of refugees seeking asylum in the United States. Through our law and security program, we focus on human rights issues that arise from U.S. government counterterrorism and national security efforts. Through our End Torture Now campaign, we were very active in helping to get the McCain Amendment passed last year that was signed into law banning the use of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment of detainees in U.S. custody. We are now very active in making sure that law is actually implemented. We work to reduce the incidence of violent hate crimes, and Human Rights First has a long history of defending human rights activists around the world. Finally, we have long played a role in international justice, and that work is now conducted under a program called Crimes Against Humanity, which of course brings us to Darfur. In 2005, we launched our Hope for Darfur campaign. HOPE stands for Help Organize a Peace Envoy. We believe a three-pronged approach to the crisis is needed. One, a political and diplomatic process to secure a peace agreement. Two, a military force to protect the civilian population. And three, humanitarian assistance. We've been focusing most of our efforts on the need for a political and diplomatic process to secure a peace agreement. I must tell you that these efforts were significantly inspired by an extraordinary man named Dr. Moudawi Ibrahim Adam. He is indeed a human rights defender and runs a local nonprofit organization in Darfur. Some of you may have read about Dr. Moudawi in Nick Kristof's Pulitzer Prize-winning columns. Working with Dr. Moudawi, Human Rights First has been urging an all-Darfur peace dialogue that would bring all parties to the table who need to be represented in a negotiation of peace. We've been urging the greater pressures needed on regional governments as well as powerful governments in the world to exercise political will to address the conflict. And notwithstanding your presence here this evening, we believe more public attention is needed to be given to the crisis in Darfur. And we believe that one way to focus attention on all of these is through a peace envoy. It's worked before. Former UN Ambassador John Danforth played a crucial role in the North-South conflict in Sudan. Former Senator George Mitchell in Northern Ireland. Richard Holbrooke in the Balkans. A high-level envoy appointed by the UN can help to make a difference when so much is at stake right now, this evening, in Darfur. On behalf of Human Rights First, it is our honor to be here with all of you, with Amnesty International, and the New York Society for Ethical Culture. It is especially a pleasure to be here with this distinguished panel. I salute you all, and I look forward to tonight's discussion. I believe we're going to have one pause to show you a brief video, and then I think we'll go into the presentations and the discussion for the evening. Thank you very much.
Hi again. I'd like to introduce our moderator, Karima Banoon. She is an associate professor at Rutgers University School of Law in Newark, where she teaches international law and human rights. Prior to beginning her academic career, she served as a legal advisor for Amnesty International, working on issues including torture and human rights in armed conflict. In summer 2005, she was elected to the board of directors of Amnesty International, USA. And in December 2005, Karima traveled to Afghanistan for Amnesty to interview released detainees. Karima, thank you.
Good evening. I would like to welcome you all on behalf of Amnesty International to tonight's event. And can I please take a moment to ask you to turn off your cell phones, pagers, and beepers so that we can focus on our distinguished speakers. First of all, I would like to acknowledge the hard work of the organizing committee and the volunteers and the sponsoring organizations, and I hope that you will help me thank them for their tremendous efforts tonight. The tasks I have been appointed are to set tonight's proceedings in the context of Amnesty's work to stop violence against women in armed conflict, and then to introduce you to our speakers. Let me begin with the first and try to be brief, which means I will necessarily be incomplete. The violence against women in the Darfur conflict has become a focal point for Amnesty's work and that of many other human rights organizations. AI has documented, among other atrocities, rapes and gang rapes of women and girls as young as 8 during Janjaweed attacks on their villages. Some of these women were then abducted and held as sexual and domestic slaves in Janjaweed camps, where they were forced to cook for their own attackers. Reportedly, some had limbs broken to prevent them from escaping. Witnesses have testified to the deliberate use of rape in Darfur to humiliate and punish entire communities and ultimately drive them from their land. One of the most devastating effects of violence against women in armed conflict is that underlying discrimination against women often magnifies the primary victimization. The social consequences of rape for women in Darfur are dire. Sexual violence is a cultural taboo. Hence, the Janjaweed know that the long-term effects will play out for women and their families for many years. The children born out of these rapes will not be accepted, and the survivors themselves will be stigmatized. As one woman interviewed by Amnesty said, quote, 5 to 6 men raped us, one after the other, for hours, over 6 days, every night. My husband could not forgive me after this. He disowned me. In March 2004, Amnesty International launched a major campaign to stop violence against women. One of its two central themes is armed conflict. The campaign seeks to draw attention to forms and consequences of gender-based and other abuses faced by women and girls and their specific needs for treatment and reparation. By fighting for alleged perpetrators in Darfur and elsewhere to be brought to justice, the campaign also seeks to combat impunity for these terrible acts. I borrowed information for this introduction from the remarks made by Amnesty's Sheila Dower at a similar event on Darfur in April 2005, and it was alarming to me how much of what she said then continues to be relevant or has actually worsened. At least 200,000 people have been killed. 2 million people are reported displaced, and over 200,000 are now refugees in Chad, where they are threatened, as you all know, by further cross-border violence. Sexual violence continues. Doctors Without Borders said they treated 500 women in 4.5 months who became pregnant as a result of rape and were subsequently, in another outrageous abuse, charged with zina, unlawful sexual intercourse, a punishable offense under Sudan's fundamentalist penal code. In the last 3 months, the security situation has deteriorated further with attacks on humanitarian convoys and obstruction of aid. And armed opposition groups fighting against the Sudanese government have also increased their attacks, perpetrating killings and abductions. Our speakers this evening will describe their work on Darfur and the kinds of solutions they see as possible for alleviating the human suffering there. If you are moved by their words, I challenge you, I challenge us all, to act. Please join Amnesty International and work on its Stop Violence Against Women campaign. Specifically, you can sign up for the Shield the Women of Darfur campaign. Go to www.amnestyusa.org/women. That's amnestyusa.org/women to do this. You can also attend the important April 30th Save Darfur Coalition rally in Washington, D.C. That's April 30th. For more information, go to www.savedarfur.org. I also encourage you to share the information you learn here tonight with at least 5 friends or family members and ask them to become involved, magnifying the impact of our event this evening. And finally, on a personal note, I would like to say, as someone very proud of her Arab and Muslim heritage, that I feel a particular sense of outrage about what is happening in Darfur and a need to act. We all have responsibilities, but I would ask tonight in particular that any of you who are like me from the Arab or Muslim communities become involved in raising awareness, both in our communities here and in our countries of origin, about these atrocities. This supports the call for decisive action on Darfur made by many human rights groups from across the Arab world in late March. And I salute the editorial from the Daily Star in Lebanon to this effect that was distributed by Fatima Rasul downstairs. And if you want to get involved in those efforts, contact the Council on Global Solutions. Finally, let me leave you with the words of some filmmakers, Jean Chamoun and Mai Masri. Though written about another conflict, they are extremely pertinent to Darfur. They said quite simply, "The dead do not sleep. They are watching us, lest we should sleep." I would ask tonight that in response to atrocities in Darfur, and after hearing the words of our speakers, we do not sleep. It is a profound honor to present to you the following panelists who are uniquely qualified to teach us all about Darfur. I just would like to let you know that you will have an opportunity to ask them questions. You were given cards, I believe, at registration, and those will be collected later on in the panel following the remarks of Traji Mustafa, and I'll announce that when it occurs. I'm going to introduce our first speaker now, and I will return to introduce each of the other speakers in turn. Nicholas Kristof, our first speaker, really doesn't need an introduction, but of course I'm going to introduce him anyway. He is an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, and on Monday he was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for his commentary in that paper. The Pulitzer Board cited in particular, quote, his graphic, deeply reported columns that at personal risk focused attention on genocide in Darfur and gave voice to the voiceless in other parts of the world. Tonight he will provide us with an overview of the conflict in Darfur, the global response, and what, in his expert opinion, we can do about it. Thank you. Nicholas Kristof.
Thank you. Thanks very much, and I'm delighted by this huge turnout. Now, I'd be the first to say that it's kind of crazy for an op-ed columnist to go repeatedly, time and again, to the same somewhat obscure place in Sudan and write about it. And that's fundamentally because of what I've seen there that I just, you know, it keeps haunting me and it keeps forcing me to go back. 2 years ago, I went to an oasis along the Chad and Sudan border. And there were about 30,000 people, Darfuris, who were gathered in this oasis under trees. And there was no international aid that had arrived at that point to help them. And so I did what reporters do. I went from tree to tree and started talking to them about their stories. Well, under the very first tree where I started, there were two brothers. One had been shot in the throat and in the jaw, and his jaw had been essentially shot off, and he'd been left for dead. His brother, who had been only shot in the foot and had been able to get away, came back at night to bury his brother, found him still alive, and carried him for the next 49 days, traveling only at night for safety reasons, before trying to get safety in this oasis. Under the next tree, there was a woman who's in her village, Ableha. Her parents had been killed and their bodies stuffed into the village well to poison it so that nobody would be able to ever return there. Then she had fled with the rest of her family, and the Janjaweed had tracked them down and killed all the men in her extended family in their hiding place. Under the third tree, there were two little orphans. There was a four-year-old girl with her carrying her one-year-old baby brother on her back, and their parents had been murdered by the Janjaweed. And there they were, alone in the world, under this tree. Under the next tree, under the fourth tree, there was a woman called Zahra, whose husband had been killed in front of her, and then her two small children had been taken and killed there. She and her two sisters had been kidnapped by the Janjaweed, sexually enslaved for several days and gang raped. And then at the end of that, one sister had her throat cut, the other had been shot, and Zahra had been mutilated to stigmatize her forever as a rape victim, and then had been left to wander back naked to see if she could find any people in her tribe. Well, those were the first four trees that I went to. And everywhere, in every direction, there were more trees and more people sheltering under them with stories just like that. And that was the moment when I realized both the scale of this and the level of atrocities, and when I really began to think of this as a major genocide that we had to address. Well, what was going on here? Darfur is, as you know, is this region in the far west of Sudan. The fundamental cleavage in Darfur is between Arab tribes and non-Arab tribes. It's not religious. Essentially, everybody in Darfur is Muslim. But that Arab and non-Arab division is accompanied by two other cleavages. One has to do with skin color, that in general, the Arabs tend to be lighter skinned and the non-Arabs, African tribes, tend to be darker skinned. And also, it is often accompanied by the kind of livelihood they have, that the Arab tribes tend to be nomadic herdsmen and the African tribes tend to be settled farmers. And so there's that kind of tension, the historic tension between the herdsman and the farmer. And that has been aggravated by conflicts, by shortages of water and forage. It's been aggravated by Arab nationalism that has infected their area and the Arab tribes. But the Sudanese government dramatically aggravated this by arming the Arab tribes and siding with them in every conflict. And then in 2003, when these African tribes formed a little incipient rebellion and attacked some military barracks, at that point, the Sudanese government essentially went nuts and adopted a policy of to crush this rebellion by wiping out the members of those African tribes, in particular the Zagawa, the Fur, and the Masalit tribes. And you saw some images here of these burned-out villages. You'd go through Darfur now, and you travel, and it's essentially a desert, and wherever there can be a well, there's a well and a little mud brick village like that. And you drive and drive, and you see one burned-out village after another, and everybody has been driven away, except that the Arab tribes have been, the Arab villages have been left alone. And everybody tells the same story. I must say it's, in that context, interviews become a little bit awkward because, when I'm driving along, if somebody sees me, their instinct is to run the other direction. And of course, when I see somebody, my instinct is to run in the other direction. And that does make interviews a little bit awkward, as you can imagine. But when when both sides do screw up their courage and I manage to talk to people who've been left behind there, who are stuck in this no man's land, then they tell identical stories. And typically, the Sudanese military attacked their village at dawn. There were a few bombs dropped, some strafing. Everybody ran out of their huts in terror. And they found that their village had been surrounded by several hundred Janjaweed. On horses, in pickup trucks, on camels. The Janjaweed opened fire with their guns. That there was a conscious effort to kill males. That with women, it was a little more haphazard. Some people let women go. Some people took women and girls to rape. And some people just killed anything that moved. But you encounter those stories in every village you go to all across the area. Well, the Sudanese government sometimes says that this is just tribal conflict between these various tribes, and that is completely untrue. It's ludicrous. The Janjaweed was armed by the Sudanese government. It wears uniforms issued by the Sudanese government. We know who the leaders of the Janjaweed are. We know that prisons were opened up so they could recruit people to incorporate into the Janjaweed. And, I must say, I was in Darfur in November, and I was coming back from a massacre site where, I think 45 people had, 45 bodies had been recovered later. There were many others missing. One woman told me how her 2-year-old child had been shot in front of her. I mean, it was a basic, your sort of typical village in Darfur where this has happened. And I'm driving back on a main road from this village, and there are Sudanese military people along this road. They're stopping me, of course, at every checkpoint. And then I pass a convoy of these Janjaweed, the people who have been doing these things. And the Janjaweed, of course, go through every checkpoint. Nobody stops them. And what was, you know, just most disheartening was at one checkpoint, the Sudanese authorities tried to arrest my interpreter, who was a member of the Fur tribe. And they told me, you know, we're going to hold on to him for investigation. You go on. And it was clear that he was going to be dead 5 minutes afterward. And, well, in the end, I was able to take him with me, and he was okay. But it was so clear that if the Sudanese authorities only applied the same restrictions to the Janjaweed that they apply to foreign journalists, the genocide would be over in a moment. This is very much a deliberate Sudanese policy. And right now we're seeing the same kind of thing happen next door into Chad. Nominally, there is a sort of a civil war happening in Chad. There's a rebellion by Chadian troops to overthrow the Chadian government. In fact, this is exactly what Sudan has done before. When Sudan was dealing with a rebellion in the south, in Christian and animist areas over the last 20 years, it sponsored private militias to wipe out villages, to depopulate large areas. And when Uganda lent support to, or when those southern rebels found refuge in Uganda, then Sudan sponsored and supported a proxy army called the Lord's Resistance Army, which has been one of the most brutal forces in the region. Well, same playbook today. Sudan sponsored the Janjaweed to attack these villages. When the Darfur rebels found, in some case, some refuge in Chad, then Sudan sponsored this proxy army, these rebels who have uniforms issued by the Sudanese government, have been recruited by the Sudanese government. They're at a base in Sudan, in Darfur, and now they've invaded Chad. There was fighting about 10 days ago in the Chadian capital. I think there's a reasonable chance, I'd say a 50-50 chance, that the Chadian government will be toppled over the next 6 months, and that this Darfur catastrophe that has, you know, already killed, we don't know, but a few hundred thousand people is a good guess, may now be allowed to expand hugely in Chad as well. What have we done? Have we responded? President Bush has been very good about providing humanitarian aid, especially to those who managed to get out to Chad so far. In general, if you can get out, you get food, you get some medical help. What we have not been good at is providing security and stopping the killing itself. And, you know, one of the most frustrating things to me is that one of the lessons of past genocides is that the bully pulpit really does matter, and you can shame countries. And Sudan is embarrassed by what is going on. And I don't think the solution is to send American ground troops into Darfur. In fact, I think that would probably make things worse. But I think we can impose a no-fly zone. And I think that we can work with the UN in pushing through a UN protection force, which will provide a lot of security. I think we can work on a much more effective peace negotiation, provide a framework using the kind of approach that Human Rights First is taking, and particularly would involve negotiations among the tribal sheikhs in the area, rather than just between the rebels and the government, who are the two most recalcitrant parties. Now, one of the things that I find just so frustrating is that Rwanda was awful, but it essentially lasted 3 months, and then it was over. And in other genocides, we've had other excuses. You know, we didn't know exactly what was going on at the time, or it was, or it happened too quickly to galvanize an action. In Darfur, it's been going on in slow motion for 3 years, and now, in fact, it's getting worse and expanding into Chad. And we don't have the excuse that we don't know what's going on. We have 200,000 people who've gone next door into Chad, whom we can access at any time, who tell us exactly what is going on. And still we don't act. One of the the incidents that I can't get out of my head that, again, drives me to go back again and again involved a young aid worker, a young idealistic aid worker who was working for an international aid organization in an area where the Janjaweed was also still active. And let me just close with what she told me. In this area, the Janjaweed had moved in and was allowing some of the local people to survive, because the Janjaweed has found that when they just wiped everybody out, then they destroyed the markets, and that then they didn't have any place to sell their meat and their belongings, and they didn't have any place to buy bridles and things they want. And so increasingly have been leaving a remnant of people alive to trade. And that's what they had done in this area. And this aid worker came and tried to talk to people about what exactly was going on. And, of course, everybody was too terrified and wouldn't talk candidly. But finally she found two sisters and took them aside and won their trust. And they told her what had happened and what was happening. And the two sisters said that the Janjaweed had moved into this family's compound and had forced their extended family to be their servants, to go get water for them, to get firewood for them, to cook for them, and had forced these two sisters to sleep with them, to be their, effectively, to be their sex slaves. And after several days of this, the father of these two girls just couldn't bear it any longer, and he went to the Janjaweed commander and got on his knees and begged him and said, you know, the rest of us will stay here, but just please let my daughters go. And that was the point when the Janjaweed commander called in the two daughters as well and beheaded their father in front of them. And this aid worker said that here she is in an area that the international community can still reach, and yet these things are still happening already after several years of this genocide, of us knowing about it. And that is the challenge that we have to address, and those are the stakes that have been underway in Darfur itself, and now those are going to be the stakes in Chad as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our second speaker this, excuse me. Our second speaker this evening is Mark Malik Brown, who is the new Deputy Secretary General of the UN. From 2005 to 2006, he was the chef de cabinet to the UN Secretary General, and in that position, he worked on all aspects of UN work, including helping to set out an ambitious reform agenda for the United Nations. Previously, he served as administrator of the UN Development Program. He was included in Time Magazine's list of the world's 100 most influential people in 2005. And this evening he will address the UN's role in Darfur and the general humanitarian effort. And he has to leave for an official engagement at about 8:15 this evening. So we thank him very much for being with us.
Thank you. I think I'm going to speak for here. I heard a certain feedback when Nick was speaking, so I think maybe this microphone is a bit more audible. But let me just start by saying that there isn't usually very much good news about Darfur. And this week, there are two, I suppose, modest, not so modest, silver linings in their way. First is Nick's Pulitzer, which is fantastic. And the second is that so many of you came out tonight to talk about Darfur. Now, that's not just a kind of nice way of opening. It really is true, because where I sit, trying to help Kofi Annan marshal the political support day in, day out for action in Darfur, we see our ability to mobilize governments to act wax and wane depending on the public pressure. I could almost calibrate the level of interest to Nick's columns. They are hugely influential, hugely influential. The problem is, even Nick can't keep the temperature up week in, week out. And as many have observed, his bravery, which is what it is to have gone in half a dozen times when he's such a well-known critic now of the government, is limited in some ways by the fact he's a print journalist, a columnist. He's not a man with a television camera. And a number of the more thoughtful television reporters, Ted Koppel just before he stepped down from Nightline, Peter Jennings in his lifetime, have analysed just what the constraints have become in modern news broadcasting to deploy a TV crew into a distant, far-off, hard-to-reach tragedy, which doesn't necessarily do much for your ratings. So we limp along with very intermittent media attention to this problem. But what Nick and I have talked about before when we've addressed audiences in New York together on this is every time more people come out to hear about Darfur. Each time the footprint is bigger. It's not as though Nick writes a column and it goes away and then, you know, you have to start again. There is a real sense that there's something building here. People do realize that this slow burn genocide that we're seeing requires this sort of level of mobilization that Tonight recognizes. And, you know, speaking for myself, my wife and two of my daughters are going to Washington next weekend for the march. And I hope many of you will too, because it really matters. And, you know, I don't use this argument lightly because, frankly, where I sit, there are many, many international political problems in the world where, however much the demonstration makes one feel good, one knows that positions are so locked in that, in a way, you're throwing yourself against a brick wall. It's not going to change things. Darfur is one where your action can change things. So really, look at this evening as part of how you get engaged and help sustain this political pressure, which is so, so vital. And it's vital, of course, because, you know, if you like, Darfur is one of those second-tier political problems. It's not Iraq. It's not Iran with its nuclear threat. It's not a Hamas government in the Palestinian territories. It's not many things. It's in the middle of Africa. Something terrible is happening, but it doesn't press immediately on US or, for that matter, British or many other countries' national interests. So it's not something that the foreign policy crowd wake up every morning and say, what are we going to do to fix Darfur? They need to be kept honest by your pressure. And the other element of it is, this is one where that sort of intermittent action that I've referred to, spurred by press coverage and then falling away as the public temperature falls down, isn't actually that cynical. There are many, many leaders in Africa, in London and Europe, in Washington, including, and I suspect to this crowd, this may not be the most popular remark I make this night tonight, including President Bush, actually, who really want to act in Darfur. This is not one where they want to just push it aside and pretend it's not there. But when I say they need to be kept honest, they need to feel that there is a constituency mobilized behind them, which is keeping them moving forward and acting. You know, for President Bush, another foreign engagement isn't an obvious vote winner. He's not had much success with his international involvement. And as Nick has argued, it's actually even more complicated than that, because it's not that a US simple, straightforward, bilateral American troops on the ground would fix the problem. It would actually make it a lot more difficult and a lot more complicated in a political sense for reasons I'll touch on in a moment. So America has to get back into that unfashionable habit and lost skill of acting multilaterally. It's got to work with others. And there are plenty in Washington who want to do that, but they need your help to keep them focused and moving in that direction. And I just want to give you a sense of just what a complicated process this is to build and sustain a strategy that gets us to where Nick wants us to be and everyone else who spoke in introducing us tonight, Human Rights First, Amnesty, want us to be, in terms of an effective deployment in Darfur combined with a political strategy to build reconciliation and peace. We have to get a whole lot of different and difficult players aimed and moving in the same direction. It starts, if you like, with the Security Council, which has to determine and decide that indeed the deployment of a UN force into Darfur is the right thing to do. And there are all kinds of national considerations at play. The African members of the council are worried that it is a loss of esteem and respect for the very hard-working African Union peacekeeping force, which is trying its best to keep some peace in Darfur, but which is under-resourced, under-equipped, and overwhelmed by the task. Other members of the council have economic and business interests, commercial interests in Sudan, which they don't want to sort of tread on lightly. And a great, decent majority of the council want to act, but start to tot up the costs of action. And I'll come back to that point too in a second. Now, once you get through the council, you get to the next two partners who also need to be going in the same direction. In ascending order of difficulty, it is first the African Union that it had agreed accepts that it needs to now become part of a bigger UN force, which, as I say, is a hard one for some parts of the region to swallow, but there is a willingness, and the African Union is committed to participating with us in such a force, and we're now engaged in trying to plan it out. But the next and much tougher step, and one which will at first sound like an absurdity to you tonight, is to get the agreement of this very same government of Sudan that Nick has just described. Now, why do we need that? Because we have to have at least minimum acquiescence on their part to deploy into their country. Because if we do it into the teeth of their opposition, it becomes a very different kind of activity altogether. In simple, non-complicated terms, it becomes an invasion. That requires a hugely larger force. It's not a business the UN is in anyway. And it would almost certainly divide the African support that we've so painstakingly built up for this operation. Now, some of you may not know, there is already a UN force in Sudan keeping the peace in the south, where there was for nearly 20 years a very long and protracted civil war, which recently ended with a peace agreement. And at the moment, the Sudanese are saying, we don't want you yet. We'd like a similar peace agreement for Darfur and then come in and help police it. But we want that peace agreement first. Well, that's an ever more unacceptable cause of delay in this deployment. So we have an envoy as we speak in Khartoum who met 2 days ago with the president and is waiting to try and see him again tomorrow in a very difficult process of getting them to accept our participation. And it'll be persuasion plus a lot of pressure before that moves. Well, then when you have Sudan, you get in line, you get to the next and in some ways the most difficult part, which is, yes, decent Western governments and their counterparts in Africa and elsewhere want us to deploy because they are as shocked individually as all of us are by what is happening. But then comes the bill, a much larger force supported by helicopters and airlift, because you have to understand Darfur is about the size of France. And at the moment you have 8,000 or 9,000 African Union troops with kind of essentially Toyotas and trucks to try and move them to where there is a problem. They can't possibly get there in time to stop the attacks on a village. They don't have the mobility or numbers to do it. So our plan is for a force considerably larger than that, backed by helicopter lift, so that when we have a report of an incident, we can get troops straight there to stop it before people are hurt, ideally. But that costs money, and it needs a lot of troops. And I have to step back and tell you that already today, the UN is deploying more troops around the world than anyone else except the United States. We have 85,000 troops, four times as many as we had 8 years ago. And every government that has to pay the bill is thinking, how can we cut troops from this mission? How can we reduce the cost? The US planning figures for this next budget assume that we're going to halve the size of our peacekeeping force in the equally precarious Democratic Republic of the Congo, close to Sudan. We can't. We're engaged in these vital operations, and when we argue, well, look, we've got 18 of these operations around the world, and they cost about the equivalent of 2 to 3 weeks of the US's own deployment in Iraq. This is very cheap peacekeeping. It doesn't.
You're not going to stand up there and keep on making goddamn excuses and let kids get killed? Are you crazy?
Could you please sit down and let the speaker continue? There'll be time for questions and answers at the end.
Get some time, get great. Would you be doing something different?
I think.
Yes, you would be doing something different.
Well, look, I really understand the passion that lies behind that question, because I think every one of us in this room wants action. It's why we're here. But I think we also have to just, you know, I'm sorry if it's painful for people, but we have to walk through the complexity of what it takes to achieve action. Not, I hope, because it amounts to an excuse, but because if we're to move this problem together, we all have to understand exactly the political hurdles we've got to overcome to get there. And my point... you know, my point is a very, very simple one in this regard, which is nobody has yet closed the gap between their passion, their own emotional and rhetorical commitment to do something about Darfur, to respond to exactly that kind of plea from the heart that people are dying in front of all of us and we've not stopped it. We haven't closed the gap between that sentiment, that urgency, and the resources of money, people, soldiers, equipment to deploy once we get the Sudanese and African Union agreement. So we've got a hell of an agenda ahead of us. In lobbying terms, we've got to get Africa on board, we've got to get Sudanese acquiescence, and then we've got to build from amongst reluctant financing countries and troop contributing countries a force of sufficient scale and robustness to take on this difficult task in the middle of nowhere in terms of the view of so many politically and in terms of military planning. Let me just close with one thing, one short straw I drew last year in the UN was to go and represent the Secretary General in Srebrenica at the 10th anniversary of the terrible genocide that occurred in that city. And, you know, I stood up in front of widows and children to explain why the UN had not acted, and people felt the same passion as the gentleman who just spoke did, and people had lost their immediate families and had come back just at the end of a painful business of trying to reassemble the remains to bury them in an extraordinary graveyard, a sort of amphitheater-like graveyard in the hills just outside Srebrenica. And, you know, I asked myself, how did that generation of UN officials let this happen? And it was because reasonable people planned, made rational calculations about the people they were dealing with, and didn't light the fire of realizing that every day we had to press with incredible urgency and single-mindedness if this was not to happen on our watch. And I don't for a moment feel any complacency or want to provide any excuse for what has happened so far. All I'm saying to you tonight is it's not just going to take UN officials with a kind of flash of the wand or a signing of a pen to solve this problem. It's going to take every one of us in this room putting our shoulder to the wheel of advocacy and lobbying to push so hard that all those who want to help but keep on being distracted by other problems will keep their shoulders at the wheel too. And if we can do that, and if Nick will keep writing, then I really think we could meet here next year and be able to say collectively, when it came to Darfur, we made a difference. Thank you.